Good morning. It's Monday, August 19th. I'm Shamitha Basu. This is Apple News Today. On today's show, the quest for peace in Gaza. A reckoning about long hours and finance after a banker's death. And why so many parents are ready for school to start back up again. But first, Democrats are gathering in Chicago for their convention, and local law enforcement is bracing for several large protests. Some started yesterday, and more are expected. In videos posted to social media, police could be seen lining the streets of downtown Chicago. Protesters are there demonstrating against U.S. support of Israel's war in Gaza. They say they want to see the U.S. stop supplying arms to Israel and an immediate ceasefire. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson told NPR his city has plans in place to balance free speech and safety.
Well, the first and foremost, protecting the fundamental right to protest in this country is why our democracy is functional. And I will do everything in my power to ensure that the First Amendment of all residents, people of this country, remain intact.
When the DNC was held in Chicago in 1968, divisions over the Vietnam War led to huge protests. PBS NewsHour looked back at that convention and the lessons for today. Back then, things came to a head when protesters tried to march to the convention hall but were blocked by police. Cameras rolled as the protesters sat down in the middle of the street. Police moved in, hitting them with clubs and using tear gas as protesters chanted, "The whole world is watching." Inside the convention hall, Democrats debated whether to call for an end to the war. Ultimately, much of the country sided with the police, and Republican candidate Richard Nixon seized upon the moment to paint Democrats as lawless. He won the election, in part, on a platform that Republicans would restore order. Chicago-based journalist Rick Perlstein, who wrote about that summer extensively, told PBS how that moment changed American politics.
It was definitely an inflection point in many, many things. It was an inflection point for the Republican politics of law and order and basically presenting themselves as the forces of hierarchy, decency. You know, if you're behind a white picket fence and work hard and play by the rules, the people Richard Nixon termed the silent majority were for you, and the Democrats are in cahoots with these anarchists, right? It was, you know, profoundly inaccurate. It was a smear. But that was the beginning of that smear.
PBS asked Perlstein to compare the protests of 1968 with today.
There's, you know, considerable group of people who are extremely passionate about what's going on in Israel and in Gaza. I would say the biggest difference is that the people who were extremely passionate about what was going on in Vietnam were young people who could have ended up in Vietnam that same month. And this is a time in which as many as 100 American soldiers were dying a day. You know, I don't want to take away from the moral passion, but, you know, this was kind of life and death.
1968-level turmoil isn't expected for this convention in Chicago, but the protests are a reminder that many Democrats are not happy with the current White House. And in an election this tight, Harris may need them if she hopes to win. Let's talk more now about where the war in Gaza stands. And a warning, this next segment contains descriptions of violence. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in the Middle East today saying this is probably the best, maybe the last, opportunity for a deal that'll end fighting and release Israeli hostages held by Hamas. Ceasefire talks are set to continue this week, but months of on and off meetings haven't led to a breakthrough. Israel and Hamas have traded blame as to who's responsible for holding up a deal. Meanwhile, in Gaza, one father's story is capturing the world's attention. It's a reminder of the stakes of ceasefire talks and the brutal toll this war is taking on innocent civilians. Mohammed Abu Al-Khomsan was with his wife and newborn twins, sheltering in an apartment building. His children were just days old, and he went to the hospital to collect their birth certificates. While he was gone, an Israeli strike hit the building, killing his wife and babies. He talked about what happened in a Reuters video.
I went to get the birth certificates for the children. My wife gave birth the day before yesterday. I hadn't yet celebrated them. And she had just delivered by cesarean section. She was still tired, and she wasn't able to get up or move much.
Reporters spoke with the Palestinian father outside a hospital at a somber public memorial ceremony on the street. An NBC video showed the father and local residents grieving and praying as the babies, named Esser and Aysel, were covered in white sheets. Allahu Akbar! Abu Al-Khomsan and his wife, Jumana Arafa, got married just over a year ago, before the conflict began. He told NBC when the couple was expecting, they took every precaution they could to prepare for the delivery. They weren't able to get out of Gaza. Like so many other Palestinians, they were displaced over and over, looking for shelter. They ended up in a humanitarian zone where they were told they would be safe. Israel initially said it didn't have any information about the incident and that it tries to avoid civilian casualties. Gaza officials say the death toll is now over 40,000 people. Every year, thousands of young people start entry-level jobs in investment banking. The promise is, if you work hard, put in your time, and move up the ranks, you can see a big payout. But the recent death of a young Bank of America associate in New York is drawing attention to the culture of overworking in the investment banking industry, and at Bank of America specifically. The Wall Street Journal looks into the story of 35-year-old Leo Lucanis. Lucanis had served in the U.S. Special Forces for over a decade and did several tours in the Middle East as a Green Beret. He then joined Bank of America as an associate and, according to people on his team, had been working more than 100 hours a week for about a month to finalize a big acquisition. They had a celebratory dinner after the deal was announced, but sometime before coming into work the next day, Lucanis died. The autopsy found a blood clot in his heart.
It has prompted a wave of scrutiny about what's going on at Bank of America, because this isn't the first person who's died while working under extreme, you know, heavy work circumstances.
That's Alexander Saidi, a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. He's referring to what happened about a decade ago when a Bank of America intern in London died of a seizure after working several all-nighters in a row. At the time, the bank created new rules around how many hours young bankers could work before their managers or HR were flagged. But Saidi spoke to dozens of people familiar with the working conditions at Bank of America, including current and former bankers, and many of them said those rules are not being enforced.
The death of Leo has really put a spotlight on whether these policies and rules really work, because Leo was on a team where we've reported that the breaking of policies meant to limit people's hours was routine. People were often asked to lie about how much they were working on Leo's team and worked more than the bank would have said would have been allowed.
Bank of America did not comment on Lucanis's work conditions, and a spokesperson said the company expects all employees to follow the rules, and when they've learned of violations, disciplinary actions have been taken. The day after the journal article was published, Bank of America reinforced this message to young bankers, telling them to accurately report the hours they work and to let superiors or HR know if they are being pressured to misreport their hours. Saidi told us these entry-level jobs can pay around $200,000 a year. Many young bankers want to stick it out in the hopes of reaching higher roles that can pay $1 million or more, and that the culture of overworking has become something of a rite of passage.
People who have gone through these experiences of working really long hours and not really being able to speak up about it, when they become bosses, they expect that their juniors will do the same thing that they did. So you see a little bit of a repeating cycle that plays out generation after generation.
Lucanis left behind a wife, two young children, and a twin brother who started work at Goldman Sachs just weeks after Lucanis' death. Before we let you go, here are some other stories being featured in the Apple News app. First, a little more on the DNC in Chicago. The 19th takes a look at an important person working behind the scenes, Mignon Moore. She's been influential in Democratic politics for 40 years, with a focus on bringing in new voices. Now she's chair of the Democratic National Convention. Early in her political career, she was involved with Reverend Jesse Jackson's 1988 presidential campaign. She was also part of Hillary Clinton's inner circle during both of her presidential runs. Moore also advised Biden to pick Harris as his running mate in 2020 and to nominate Ketanji Brown Jackson to be the first Black woman on the Supreme Court. Now Moore is running the convention that'll put the first Black woman and first Asian American on top of a major party presidential ticket. We'll end with a couple of stories on education. The first involves a cheating scandal in one of the country's best-known math contests, the American Mathematics Competitions. This is a really high-pressure, super intense contest for the country's top high school mathletes. It can make a big difference on college applications and for future jobs. Now, the Wall Street Journal explains there have long been rumors of some level of cheating, but recently, whole exams were leaked online days before testing. The people behind the competition say they took immediate steps to try to minimize the damage, including scrambling multiple choice answers. But lots of students say it's hard to feel good about the results, not knowing who may have cheated. And the other education story is one that may hit close to home if you're a parent who's totally worn out with the summer and is definitely ready for your kids to get back to school. The Atlantic looks at studies on the high cost of school closures. That includes the literal cost of childcare expenses and the cost to the mental health of parents. What researchers found won't surprise many mothers. When schools are closed, for summer, for teacher strikes, for COVID, women are disproportionately affected. For this and other reasons, there are more calls for school systems to consider year-round schedules. Philadelphia is piloting this in several schools this year. As The Atlantic points out, even if not everybody likes to hear it, schools do more than just educate. They're also childcare, freeing up parents to work. The problem is schools often don't get the resources to adequately do everything society expects them to do. Reconsidering schedules and funding may be a way to improve things for kids and their parents, especially mothers. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the News app right now, we've got a narrated article coming up next. Rolling Stone spends time with Ohio Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown, who's fighting for his political survival this November. His race could determine which party controls the Senate. If you're listening in the podcasts app, follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story. And I'll be back with the news tomorrow.